Hey there, how are you doing?
Good.
Right on. So Kevin, I'm glad to have you on the air.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, to begin, I've introduced you as a member of the Truth Commission to Genocide in Canada. And maybe I'll read a little excerpt from, I guess you call it a book or a report. And then from there you can introduce yourself and
sure.
Answer the question, I guess. So to begin with, I'll just introduce a bit of the excerpt here, which is, "The history of purposeful genocide implicates every level of government in Canada, the RCMP, every mainline church, large corporations, and local police, doctors, and judges. The web of complicity in this killing machine was, and remains, so vast that its concealment has required an equally elaborate campaign of a cover-up that has been engineered at the highest levels of power in our country, a cover-up that is continuing, especially now that eyewitnesses to murders at the church-run residential schools that constituted the death camps of the Canadian Holocaust, and within their walls, nearly one-half of all Aboriginal children sent there by law died or disappeared, according to the government's own statistics." Now, that covers a lot, and it's a pretty hard-hitting paragraph there. And I wonder if you can maybe just introduce your work and what you're getting across with the support, and go from there.
Okay, thanks, man. Well, my work really started over 10 years ago in Port Alberni on the west coast of Vancouver Island. And I was a minister in the United Church there, and I began to hear a lot of these stories on the ground from Native survivors of the United Church Residential School in Port Alberni. And in a nutshell, what happened is, as I tried to raise this, you know, the evidence with the church, I was summarily expelled between 1995 and 97 without cause or any kind of due process. I expelled as a minister in the church, and I then began to work more directly with the Native people all over the west coast of BC with their attempt to bring the truth out of what happened in these residential schools. I was an advisor in the first lawsuits brought by the survivors of the United Church School in Port Alberni, and that case actually was very groundbreaking in Canada, because what it did was establish that both the church and the government were equally liable for all the crimes that happened in the residential schools. So ever since then, I've been working to simply document with eyewitnesses and with a lot of documentation that I found in archives and libraries across Canada to show that what happened in the residential schools wasn't just about physical and sexual abuse. It wasn't some kind of accidental or random system. It was a whole system set up in 1920 by the federal government and the Catholic, Anglican, and United Church and its predecessors to basically exterminate over half the Native people, especially in the West, where a lot of the residential schools were built, and to eradicate any control Native nations would have over their own lands and resources. And they succeeded. The death rate in the residential schools was over 50% every year, and we have documents to show that, the actual government documents revealing this death rate. Also, the schools were used as basically a way to use Native people as fodder in medical experimentation programs. Also, there were large sterilization centers on the west coast of BC, especially, run by the United and Catholic churches, where they were basically making infertile any Native people who weren't surrendering their land and becoming Christian. So this is a vast system of really genocide and crimes against humanity. And unfortunately, there hasn't been a way in Canada to address this, because the courts, of course, are part of the very system that caused this. And so what our hope is to get international pressure, an international tribunal brought by different countries to actually put Canada on trial for these crimes.
Have you been making any headway at all on that?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we tried the formal route first back in 1998. We held a tribunal in Vancouver where we invited a UN group and Aboriginal elders to come and hear these stories. We had over 20 hours of videotape and other documents to show all this stuff. We sent it off to the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and never heard anything back. We subsequently heard that the Canadian government had brought a lot of pressure to bear to keep this whole issue off the agenda of the UN. But around 2001, other Native groups around the world began to raise this, and through other means, we've been able to get some recognition of this happening at the international level. For example, in 2004, a group of Mayan Aboriginal groups in Guatemala got a Spanish edition of my book, Hidden from History, and they wrote three different letters, or what they call denuncias, which are formal protests, about the genocide of Native people in Canada. They sent that to the Canadian government and never got any kind of substantive response at all. And so the Guatemalans announced that they, along with several other countries, hopefully Belgium and Ireland as well, are in the process of bringing a motion at the General Assembly to have Canada investigated for these crimes of genocide. So I think there is some progress being made, but it's only been because we've been able to get the story outside the country. There's been a whole conspiracy of silence in Canada to shut down any mentioning of this issue. You'll notice you won't ever see any of this in the so-called mainstream press. And the courts have been actively colluding with the churches and the government to make sure that the deeper stories of crimes and murder are kept out of the courtrooms and the public awareness.
Mm-hmm. Another excerpt from a book that I liked was, unlike post-war Germans, Canadians have yet to acknowledge, let alone repent from, the genocide being inflicted on millions of conquered people, the Aboriginal men, women, and children who were deliberately exterminated by racially supremacist churches and state. And can you speak a bit more about responses? You've been accustomed to responses from different levels of government as well as people, and with all these tribunals, about just how difficult it is for most privileged Canadians to acknowledge this or even think about it.
Yeah, there's a real level of denial and anger about this among so-called white Canada. There, I would say of all the different forums I've spoken in over 10 years now, there's only been a minimal kind of response by Caucasian Canada to this whole undeniable fact now that genocide wasn't just accidental, it was deliberate. For example, the smallpox epidemics that swept the country. Here in B.C., it's at a lot of the villages on Vancouver Island, we've documented that the numbers went down by over 95%, and that this was a common practice. One of the things we quote in the book is a report by Dr. Peter Bryce, who was the head medical officer for Indian Affairs. And in 1907, he did a tour of a lot of the residential schools in Western Canada, and he found that it was a deliberate practice of the staff and the church employees in these schools to deliberately expose children who are healthy to tuberculosis and then let them die unattended. And that's why that death rate was so high. So, in other words, what was going on was a deliberate policy of germ warfare as a main means to bring down the population. They wanted to depopulate whole areas to allow white settlement and, you know, the exploitation of the resources. So when we bring out all these undeniable facts in front of people, we have the oral testimonies of survivors, we also have the documentation, we show it to a lot of Canadians, and the attitude is they can't deny it, so they simply get angry, and they shut their eyes. Yeah, I can give you a very specific example of that. Last April, a number of our people in Vancouver held several vigils outside churches that were responsible for this Holocaust, including the Anglican and United Churches. We were simply handing out information asking the heads of these churches to identify where the children are buried, the thousands of children who died in these residential schools, because as a basic humanitarian gesture, just to have the remains brought home and buried. And the churches responded by calling the police on us. We weren't even standing on their property, we were just standing on the sidewalk. The police showed up and literally forced us off a public sidewalk at the behest of these church officials. So they are in such denial that all they do is, you know, call the police and try to shut down any discussion of this.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that conditions in residential schools could not have been a deliberate policy set forth by the government. And people also, you know, question the relevance of talking about this, since, you know, people say, well, it happened decades ago. You know, what's the point of talking about it now? And it's an easy way to have it reign in the past and not have to take responsibility for it. But if it was something that's continuing ongoing and the Saucy reparations made, then it's up to us to take responsibility for that then.
Yeah. Well, part of the defense, kind of like the psychological defense people have, is, yeah, these are crimes of the past and it's not relevant to now. But a couple of things on that. First of all, it is ongoing. It isn't, when you have a system of genocide, it's not like it stops one day. The only reason it stopped, for example, in Nazi Germany is they were conquered in a war. But the institutions that did these crimes are still intact, they're still in power. And they're the ones determining if this is talked about, the so-called compensation being given to Native people, which is minimal, if anything at all, and you know, whether or not this is addressed in the courts. It's all being controlled by the very institutions that did the crimes. And what they're not looking at, if you look at the death rate in Aboriginal communities today, It's just as high as it ever was at the times of the residential schools. The death rate due to malnutrition and poverty among native children on the west coast of British Columbia is as high as it is in Guatemala. Death rate due to AIDS, and the level of violence in any native community is unbelievable when you compare it to, you know, in the non-native world. The death due to violence suicide, Aboriginal suicide among teenagers is 15 times the national average. These are all indications that there's a system in place that's ongoing of trying to dispossess Native people from their own land and culture. The number of Native children in white foster homes in B.C. has actually increased fivefold since 1990. And the number of people being forced off their land in northern B.C., basically in order for large hydroelectric and mining companies to get their land, it's increasing constantly. So all of this is a sign of a system of genocide that's still in place. And it's really not the institutions that did these crimes are in no position to even identify these crimes, let alone do something about them, because they, you know, they have a vested interest in keeping it all covered up and ongoing.
Mm-hmm. You touched on this a bit. Can you speak about the relationships between churches, theft of land, and multinational corporations going on?
Well, there's a direct connection. This is much more common and more obvious in Western Canada, but it did, of course, happen all over the country. Basically, the way it worked historically is the government would simply declare that all Native land is Crown land, and the government would then parcel out the land to different churches when their missionaries arrived in the particular area. For example, in B.C., there were land grants. They called them clergy land grants put aside, where the Protestant and Catholic churches were simply given hundreds of acres of land by the government to operate on. So the churches owned this land. Years later, the churches would then sell this land, and this is happening constantly. They'd sell it off to their various corporate benefactors and other associates. And I have actually, my story is very tied up with that issue, because in 1994, when I was a United Church minister, I discovered that the United Church had been selling off native land belonging to the Ahouset people on Vancouver Island to McMillan Bloedel, which is at the time it was the largest logging company in BC and a major contributor to the United Church. Basically, the church was taking land that had been stolen or given to its early missionaries and then selling off that land without consulting the Ahouset people at all. They simply sold it to businessmen associated with McMillan Bloedel. And in return, we found that there was thousands of dollars in kickbacks going back to church officials in Port Alberni. When I wrote about all this to the church, and I didn't even go to the media at that point. I was still naively thinking the church would do something about this if I pointed it out. When I wrote to the United Church about this, I was summarily fired, taken out of my pulpit within 2 months. And then there was an amazing kind of cover story and smear done on me in order to cover up these facts and to divert people's attention from the fact that basically the land grab going on and the dispossession of Native people from their land was something very much and is still being very much mediated by these different churches that had Native land originally.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit more about your story? Because I know I think you're also doing a PhD at UBC when you uncovered this warehouse.
Well, I was.
Yeah.
After I was fired from the church, there was no way for me to make a living. There was a real blacklisting brought against me, so I couldn't get a job in any church. So I went back to the University of British Columbia to get a PhD in Native Studies. In a nutshell, what happened is the United Church intervened and made sure I didn't get any funding for my program. They did that because they had actually one of their officials was in my department, and he was responsible for establishing, you know, who would get teaching assistantships and bursaries and things like that. And even though I had an average of 89%, which is well within the range of getting funding, for 2 years in a row, I didn't get an ounce of funding from the department. And as a result, I couldn't pay for the completion of my degree, and I couldn't finish that. And that was one example. There's actually been many of the way churches and their lawyers, the United Church has intervened to stop me earning a livelihood, getting any kind of academic credibility. What I did, knowing that, is I did an end run around that kind of interference, and I took a lot of the information that I was going to produce for my PhD thesis, and that I produced Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust. I took that information and published it, and I figured it was more important to get the information out publicly than to simply have it in a a thesis sitting on a library shelf somewhere. So that's kind of some of the background about how the story got out in terms of, you know, my involvement. But, the interference by the churches has been continual. They've, for example, on several occasions tried to bring lawsuits against me to silence any public discussion of this. And that happened in 2002. They got a Supreme Court order, actually, in B.C., ordering that I not talk about certain aspects of the deaths of children in residential schools. But, my response continually has been to simply say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. I have the right, natural rights, and under the Charter of Rights as well in Canada, to speak about these things. And so what's interesting is the more I do that, the threats tend to fall away. For example, the threats of lawsuits have never been acted on by the church. The last thing I think they want to do is to get me into a courtroom, because then I can start demanding all sorts of documents from them. I think these things are mostly aimed at people who are stepping on toes, and they're used as scare tactics to try to silence people.
Mm-hmm. Something interesting I was reading yesterday, actually, in an article by Ward Churchill, was saying that Adolf Hitler actually was inspired to conduct his policy of conquest across Europe. He was inspired by the Europeans that came to North what's now called North America. And I find that really interesting that, like, the actual colonization process that happened in North America inspired Adolf Hitler to conduct his genocidal process. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about where the term Final Solution came from, because in their book, Hidden from History, you say that it came from the Department of Indian Affairs superintendent.
Yeah, that reference by Hitler to the genocide of native people is actually very well known. He mentions that in his book Mein Kampf, where he says his plan against the Jews of Europe, he models it on the plan of the United States government against the Indian people. Of course, that applies to Canada as well. And the term Final Solution was used continually in government correspondence in the early 20th century about native people. And the more blatant example, and I talk about this in my book, is the reference by Indian Affairs Superintendent Duncan Campbell Scott. In 1910, he got a letter from an Indian agent in B.C., where the Indian agent is describing how children are in much healthier conditions in their own villages, but that when they're brought into residential schools, they start dying at a very high rate from the tuberculosis. And Duncan Campbell Scott says, it's true that the mortality rate is much higher in the residential schools than in their villages. And here's a quote, but such is in keeping with the policy of this department, which is geared towards the final solution of the Indian problem, unquote. So, I mean, in other words, he's saying, yes, we have to maintain this high death rate to solve the Indian problem. So that's a clear statement of intent to commit genocide. Now, it's really odd, because when you have an intentional statement like that under the law, that's proof enough that these were not, kind of crimes of omission, but actually intended mass murder. And yet, even though continually we've introduced this kind of evidence in the courts, the judges continually rule that, no, there wasn't intended murder here. It was simply a system of denying children education or something like that. So, the evidence is all over the place, and I think the problem isn't lack of evidence. The problem is where you're going to take the evidence,
Mm-hmm. And so what are some plans you're doing right now? Like, I know I got a call out recently about boycott of churches or public banning of churches, and I wonder if you can talk a bit more about the demands or what you want to see happen, essentially, or even realistically it might not happen considering what's going on with the institutions today, but what kind of demands you're making from the Truth Commission?
Sure. Well, actually, like I mentioned, last April, there was April 15th, there was a letter issued by 30 different elders from different Native nations across Canada, including people in our Truth Commission here in Vancouver. And the letter demanded from the Anglican, Catholic, United, and Presbyterian churches and the federal government, it demanded to know the fate and the location of the remains of the children who died in the residential schools. And there was no response of any kind received from any of those institutions. And so on October 15th, that's 6 months later, the same group of elders issued a banning order, which in the traditional cultures in North America, was a way to expel people from their community when they were involved in different crimes. They were simply banned and shunned by the community. So these elders relied on traditional native law, and they declared these churches and the government of Canada banned bodies. That is, no, they're urging people to have nothing to do with them, not pay them any money or taxes, not to put any money in a plate on Sunday in churches or even attend these churches. And that's a banning that is ongoing until these churches start acknowledging the location of the children who died in their institutions. So that's in effect now. And in fact, on the Sunday, November 13th, there are going to be actual civil disobedience and other public actions beginning aimed at these churches and the government.
It's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
There's a few more things I want to talk to you about. And, well, one of which is that in relation to privilege, like you and I are both privileged white males, and we, I wonder if you can speak about the responsibility people of privilege have in regards to the colonialism our privilege rests upon. And what has it been like for you taking such an active stand against these issues?
What? Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear because there's somebody talking.
No problem.
You, what people can do?
Well, like, just you can speak about the responsibility people of privilege have
In
regards to the colonialism that our privilege rests upon.
Well, for one thing, you know, we are conditioned as members of a colonial system to think that it's always a question of what we do, that we have the means of, you know, fixing the situation. We're just conditioned to think that way. When we came here, our ancestors said, well, these native people are lacking, they're deficient in Christianity. We have to bring it to them and civilize them. And now the same attitude is, well, these poor people need healing and compensation. Here, we'll give them some money or some solutions and that'll fix it. The problem is not so much native people as us and our system of genocide and conquest, which is embedded in our laws and our religions and our whole way of looking at the world. And the first thing we have to do is decolonize our own thinking so we're not part of the system anymore. We have to stop thinking like the way we've been taught and stop acting in ways which are just maintaining this whole system of really corporate capitalism and imperialism around the world. And it really begins here at home. It's not just a matter of being worried about Iraq, but look at how the same system is causing this kind of destruction right here in our own backyard. So a concrete thing people can do, of course, is boycott these churches and government and download the information from our hiddenfromhistory.org website and start distributing that, ordering copies of my book and getting it into the local libraries. And also taking more public action against the perpetrators of these crimes. I think it's, you know, in any community, what you find happening right now, for example, is the United Church and Anglican Church have launched this big public campaign where they're supposedly concerned about the disappearing Aboriginal women in northern B.C. And, I mean, the hypocrisy is mind-blowing because these very institutions that caused many Aboriginal women and children to disappear and are still not saying what happened to these children, they're now pretending that they're concerned about Native people today. And what we have to say in a very loud and clear way to these churches is you have to start cleaning up your own backyard. You have to admit what you did. You've got to bring forth the perpetrators because the last residential school didn't close till 1984. Many of these abusers and torturers of children are still within the churches and are being concealed by them. And there has to be a spotlight brought on all that. So people can help in a lot of ways how to do that, you know, with public education and action. You know, trying to get some sympathetic member of parliament to stand up and read out these crimes in parliament and say, when are these churches and when is the government going to be held accountable? There's a lot of things people can do, and a specific thing right away, of course, is just to contact our Truth Commission and set up a correspondence. And I speak all over the country all the time, and I'd be happy to come anywhere and talk about this and help people organize.
Mm-hmm. And you got a lecture series going on, and one of the titles in particular, I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about, is Genocide in Canada Today, Unlearning Empire and Building a Culture of Resistance Among Native and Non-Native People. And I like that title a lot, and I wonder if you can talk a bit about the subject of that, how that relates to all of this.
Sure. Well, you know, again, it's like the focus we have to have more and more is on today and how we have to undo a system which is continually robbing people of their land and really despoiling all of us. I mean, the thing to understand, I think, about genocide is that it's initially aimed at certain groups, but it eventually attacks all of us. and you look at what's happening to the land and the increasing attacks on civil rights in Canada, the you know, for example, mandatory vaccination legislation that's been brought in recently, whereby no Canadian citizen can refuse a vaccination or from, you know, from the government as part of the whole American you know, so-called prevention of terrorism legislation. All of these things are able to happen because there's been a system in place for centuries of oppression and genocide. And it, sure, it attacked Native people first, but it's really ultimately aimed at anybody who stands in the way of this empire of genocide. And what we need to do is to relate, you know, our concerns about the crimes against Native people to the whole broader issue of how do we create that resistance now to, you know, the reality is our planet's being completely destroyed, and I think anybody with the least awareness is aware of that. And it's a legacy of genocide. So we've got to undo that in our thinking and the way we live.